You're listening to Borders-ish, a podcast about the boundaries in our lives. I'm Amaya Hadap.
And I'm Anna Allport.
Think about the neighborhood you live in. What defines it? Are there strict boundaries, streets that concretely set it apart from the next neighborhood over? Neighborhood borders are often loose feelings rather than harsh lines on a map.
At least that's the case in Queens, New York, between the neighborhoods of Flushing and Whitestone. Lois Wu chats with some residents and investigates this question of what defines a neighborhood and its borders.
I grew up in a quiet neighborhood about a 20-minute drive east of downtown Flushing. Flushing's always held a special place in my heart. It's where the closest subway station to my house is, and more importantly, where I can always get cheap Asian food. Let me paint a picture of Flushing for you. The feel of the neighborhood really varies depending on where you are. Downtown Flushing is always busy. It's where the train station is, and there's constantly traffic, honking buses, passing cars, and crowded sidewalks. But if you go a little under 2 miles to the east, by what's called Bound Park, you'll wake up to chirping birds and quiet. As a side note, I recommend pulling up a map of the area throughout this episode. You can just type Flushing into Google Maps to get one. So, what are the borders of Flushing? Growing up, I was never quite sure myself. Flushing seemed to bleed like an amorphous mass into the general area of Eastern Queens. So like any Gen Zer, I first took to the internet to try to find the borders of Flushing. I looked at Google Maps, Wikipedia, and a map created by two New York City high schoolers, popularized by Reddit. All three sources had differently shaped borders. One was small and I-shaped, the other was a bit larger and vaguely L-shaped with a thick bottom line of the L, and the last was egg-shaped and traced an area almost double the size of the L-shaped map. Looking at these maps, I was really confused. I didn't know where to start. Almost none of the borders agreed with each other. But before I get into exploring these borders from a street-level perspective, speaking to local residents and businesses, let's look at the history. I've mentioned a lot of place names so far, so maybe a bit of history will help make things a bit less confusing. As I've hinted at, Flushing's particularly known for its delicious Asian food. It has attracted Asian immigrants since the late 20th century and is still a growing ethnic enclave. But the term Flushing has been used to label the area since the 1600s.
So, history of Flushing, you know, it's established in 1645 by the Dutch.
That's Jason Ontos, a local history writer and journalist, and the current Queens Historical Board president. He grew up in Flushing and continues to live there today. Historically, Jason told me, Flushing had well-defined borders. It was set up by a Dutch patent, also known as a land grant, and encompassed everything between Flushing Bay and Little Neck Bay, north of Jamaica. Imagine a rectangle about 4 miles wide and 5 miles high. That would be the township of Flushing. It's an even larger area than the I, L, and egg-shaped maps I mentioned earlier. It's an area almost double the size of the largest of those. But most people don't think of the entire area of the township when they think of Flushing. They think of those smaller shaped maps. Jason walked me through the history of Flushing. For the most part, the area was very rural, like upstate New York, vast farmland rural. It wasn't until the late 1920s to early 30s, with President Roosevelt's New Deal and Mayor LaGuardia's terms in office, when Flushing started to urbanize.
There was this entire revitalization of the city, including Queens. And it went from rural to like urban or semi-urban within less than 10 years.
One of the areas that can be considered semi-urban is this northeastern part of what people today think of Flushing. This area borders on a neighborhood called Whitestone. Looking at these different I, L, and egg-shaped maps, this semi-urban northeastern edge was where they seemed to mostly agree. I decided to speak to local residents and businesses to hear their perspective on how they viewed the neighborhood. One such business is Merino Supermarket.
Merino started just over 35 years ago in the location on the corner of 163rd and 29th.
That's Brendan McCarthy, manager of Merino Supermarket. He was born in Flushing and grew up living in Queens, Manhattan, and parts of Long Island. He has managed Merinos now for the last 9 years. So what neighborhood does Brendan consider Merinos to be in?
Zip code and the mailing address were in Flushing, but this area of Flushing is pretty unique in its identity, I believe. So most people would refer to this as Auburndale.
Auburndale? I was shocked. Growing up in the area, I always thought Auburndale was a neighborhood further to the east. So I had to ask, what would you define as the borders of Auburndale?
So to me, it's probably from Francis Lewis Boulevard to Northern Boulevard in terms of the east and south. There's a very kind of unique architecture of the homes, of identity of kind of the blocks, and the way kind of the neighborhood looks and feels.
I decided to turn next to one of the residents in the neighborhood. Catherine Jano is a 19-year-old college student. She was born and raised in a house four blocks west of Marino's. One of the first things I asked her was to draw the borders of her neighborhood.
Can you pull up the map again? I think honestly that would be easier.
Her borders were slightly different than Brendan's. Her eastern and southern borders were a bit closer, a bit smaller than his. But generally, they weren't too different. What about what she calls the neighborhood? When asked, Catherine says that she lives in Flushing, not Auburndale. But she didn't always identify as being from Flushing.
When I was younger, I was convinced we lived in Whitestone because for me, I thought Flushing meant the city part of Queens, sort of, like a lot of busy streets, crowded stores, stores everywhere. So basically, I thought Flushing was just Main Street and Whitestone was the suburbs. I found out later in high school that if my address has Flushing in it, I probably live in Flushing. So that was definitely a realization.
But really, she recognizes that the way someone defines a neighborhood is inherently subjective. When speaking about how she drew the borders of her neighborhood, she said,
"Really, it's a self-centered description based on where I go in my neighborhood, to be quite honest."
She drew the boundaries based on the places she'd often walk to, or the streets that made her feel like she's basically there when she turns onto it on her drive home. So, neighborhood borders are subjective, and these two neighbors disagree about the name and the exact borders of their neighborhood. But does it all really matter? Though Brendan and Catherine had different names and definitions of the same general area, they seem to agree that neighborhood borders are flexible spaces. As Catherine put it,
"So to me, I kind of like to think about neighborhoods as like squiggly lines. Because there's a lot of like enmeshment that you can find. Like, I don't know, when I was younger, we used to go to Astoria all the time. And so a lot of the time, I actually thought I lived in Astoria. My school was in Astoria. My mom was driving us to Astoria all the time. Piano, karate, dance, all in Astoria. So when other kids would ask me when I was like in first grade, I'd be like, around here, Astoria. I lived nowhere near. You had to literally drive 30 minutes for me to get home. Like, it was absolutely incorrect. But because I was spending so much time here, to me, I felt like I was part of Astoria."
For Catherine, a neighborhood border and a neighborhood name are important for fueling a sense of pride. She now attends NYU and takes pride in saying that she's from New York. She's from Flushing. But strict borders, to her, are only necessary for the government to delineate.
I'm not some gatekeeper. So I think if we're talking about like people saying very specific boundaries, that's ridiculous. No one's a gatekeeper, except the government.
I'm sure you've all heard of the common phrase, "You can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy." Catherine's echoing something similar. You can tell someone they don't live in a specific neighborhood, but you can't prevent the neighborhood from shaping someone's identity all the same. It's a sentiment Brendan also expressed. A belief that borders and neighborhood names don't really mean much. These two neighbors, located just four blocks apart, don't agree on the name of their neighborhood or the rough borders of it. But they do agree that borders are arbitrary. What ties someone to a neighborhood is just a feeling, their sense of connection. Perhaps, rather than "you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy," we should start using the phrase, "you can gatekeep the neighborhood name from someone, but you can't take the neighborhood out of them." On second thought, it doesn't roll off the tongue as easily. I get it. I won't be offended if it doesn't catch on. But the idea remains all the same. Growing up, I've always been someone who likes looking at the details. I like being able to say this is where one neighborhood definitively ends and the other begins. perhaps there's value in the ambiguity. Borders aren't always clear-cut, they aren't always straight in the same way streets are, but life isn't drawn out on perfect, neat maps. Perhaps we should think of borders as squiggly lines, as Catherine put it, rather than straight ones.
Thank you for listening to the final installment in our 9-part series about the borders in our lives. We are your hosts, Anna Allport and
Maya Haddad.
Special thanks to Joe Richman for his guidance in creating this podcast, and we hope you all enjoyed listening. This has been Borders-ish.